Genealogy by Tim, Season 6, Episode 4, recorded April 25th, 2026. I'm Tim of genealogybytim.com. You can email me at tim@genealogybytim.com. And this month on the podcast, I've made major progress in my PALS application. That's the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society of the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. And also this month, I'm remembering four people I should have spoken with more, but never managed to. I discovered their obituaries over the last week, and I'll be reminding you that the most fragile genealogical resource is the human memory, so talk to people while you can. All that coming up on Genealogy by Tim. I explained the details of the PALS application that I'm preparing in the final episode of Season 5, which was published in December of last year. Basically, the goal is for me to prove descendancy from a Pennsylvania resident of colonial times. And for doing this, I'll receive a certificate, a pin, and the admiration of other members of the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. But it is quite an honor because the standards of the Genealogical Society are quite high. There are certain documents that were accepted in my application to the Sons of the American Revolution that the Genealogical Society will not accept in PALS applications. Most notably among these is the published county history called the Biographical Annals of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, published in 1903. As far as I know, this is the best evidence of my descendancy from Mary Heestand, who married Joseph Hogendobler in the early 1800s, and she was born 1792 and died 1840. I currently don't have any primary documents that identify her maiden name other than its publication in the Biographical Annals. But this resource is not permitted by the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania because the information is gathered secondhand using interviews of events described long after they occurred, and so they're not as reliable as primary documents. Fortunately, the completion of my goal does not rely on identifying Mary Heestand's maiden name, since I'm going up the Hogendobler line. So I can sidestep that little historical question and use Lancaster County land records to prove descendancy from John Hogendobler, who was born in 1745, to his son, Joseph Hogendobler, who was born in 1782, and through Joseph's daughter, Catherine, who was born in 1813. So again, I detailed much of this in Episode 5 of Season 5, which was the final episode that I recorded last year. So I won't rehash all of that now. You're welcome to go reconsider Season 5 of Episode 5 for all of those details. But I did make some updates to the application over the past month that took a noticeable amount of effort over the last several weeks. First thing I did was transfer the information from the old formatted application to the new formatted application. The application has been reformatted recently from portrait format to landscape format, and this is an improvement because I can fit more detailed source information into the application's fields without having to stretch or cram a whole lot of lines of information into the source field. And this was actually a little bit tricky for me because the downloadable form that's available on the Genealogical Society's website is in DocX format. But I'm on Linux, so I don't use Microsoft Word. I use LibreOffice, which saves documents in the ODT format. That is Open Document Text format. And I actually had a little bit of trouble with this because I'd work for several hours on the form, and I'd use LibreOffice to save it in DocX format, and then I'd come around later to open my work, and I'd find the file is corrupted. So there's a little issue there with solving DocX formats using LibreOffice. After two attempts at that, I said, nope, I'm going to use the ODT format, and then if I have to convert it back to DocX after all of it's done, I can do that, but For now, I'm working in ODT, and I haven't run into any corruption issues since then. So this is basically take three, filling in this application, and that consumed a lot of my genealogy hours this month. But now I've got the application just about finished. I gotta put some stylistic finishing touches on it, making sure that all the text that I've added is in the same color and it's in the same size and font. And then once that's done, I can move on to actually preparing my source documents with the appropriate headers, explaining what each one is included for, where it fits in the chain of ancestors, stretching all the way back to colonial times. And in addition to transferring the data from the old formatted application to the new application, I swapped out a few obituaries for their actual state vital records counterparts. And this is preferred by the Genealogical Society. They have a list of preferred documents, what they consider to be the highest quality, mid-quality, low-quality, etc. And vital records are required for the first three generations. I originally had obituaries for my paternal grandparents and one of my great-grandmothers. And this was accepted by the Sons of the American Revolution when I prepared my application for them back in 2017. But the Genealogical Society prefers vital records, especially for those first three generations. So I went ahead and placed the orders. My grandparents died at home in North Wildwood, New Jersey. My grandmother died in 2008. My grandfather died in 2016. Both in the same house in Wildwood, New Jersey. So I ordered their death certificates through Vital Check, and then also my great-grandmother. This is the mother of my grandmother, Joanna Christina Smith Harrison, who died in 1987. I ordered her death certificate from the Pennsylvania Department of Health. So whereas the New Jersey Department of Health uses Vital Check to process their death certificate requests, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has an in-house online death certificate request service that they use. It's at mycertificates.health.pa.gov. So I purchased those documents. They both reported that they might take a couple months to send those certificates to me, but in reality it turned out just to be a couple weeks, so I was pleased with the speed that these vital records were returned to me. But one thing I kind of winced at a little bit was the price of these. And I'm thinking back when I started genealogy, I worked part-time, I didn't have a whole lot of money. Dropping $40 on a death certificate was kind of out of the question, especially if I already pretty much knew the information from obituaries. But now that I'm gainfully employed and I want this application to be the best that it can be for the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania, I held my nose and clicked purchase on these documents, which kind of averaged out to be about $40 a piece when you include shipping. And one little bit of disappointment for me when I received my grandparents' death certificates is that the cause of death was redacted. Now, I thought I had gone through the website and identified myself as a grandchild, and maybe that would entitle me to receive the full unredacted document, but apparently not. And I wonder if I paid a little more for certified copies, maybe if that would show the cause of death information. In any case, that's not crucial for the PALS application. It's just interesting to me as a family historian to have the official cause of death recorded somewhere. But in any case, those documents were received in good order, and I scanned them up and I added them. I swapped out the obituaries that I was using for this information, and I inserted the official vital records death certificates for my paternal grandparents and my paternal grandmother's mother. And lastly, perhaps the most interesting addition I made to my library of documents that I'm including with this application are the court records from the 6th of June, 1769, that specifically identify John Hogendobler, who was born in 1745, as the son of Nicholas Hogendobler, who was presumably born in Switzerland and came to America with his family, his wife Helena Marie, his son John, a few of his other children, in 1750. So when I'm submitting my PALS application to the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania, I'm actually bumping that application back a generation beyond what I submitted for the Sons of the American Revolution the Sons of the American Revolution application ended with John, who was the Revolutionary War soldier, but his father, Nicholas, also moved here from Switzerland and settled in Lancaster County in 1758. So I have that. It's a, now the legal document is a record of administration. Now Nicholas Hogendahler died in 1768. He died intestate. Administrators were named as John Hogendahler, his son, and his wife, Marie. And then they presented their record of administration to the court in 1769. So I have that document, which I found through FamilySearch.org's new full-text search feature. And I have the original letter of administration that is on file at the Lancaster County Archives. And those documents prove that final generational link between John Hogendahler and his father, Nicholas. And as a little icing on the cake here, I also found through FamilySearch.org a tax record that includes Nicholas Hogendahler upon his arrival in Manor Township, Lancaster County in 1758. So that is being presented as Nicholas Hogendahler's first evidence of residency in the United States in Pennsylvania after his arrival in 1750. So I can't really say that he was a resident of Pennsylvania in 1750. For all I know, he could have arrived in 1750, lived in Maryland for 8 years, and then moved to Lancaster County. But that tax document that says he arrived in Manor Township in 1758 is the earliest record of Pennsylvania residency of any of my ancestors, at least that I'm currently aware. Now, I may next year complete another PALS application for some Mama ancestors, and I believe the earliest Mama arrived in America in the 1740s. Now, whether or not I have any tax documents or land documents that show residency in Pennsylvania in the 1740s, I'm not entirely sure, but that seems to be the direction I'll be heading next. Once this PALS application is complete, I will be working on a PALS application for the Mamas. So there you have it, and that's what I've been spending most of my genealogical research time on this month, just preparing this application, swapping out obituaries for death certificates, adding this 1769 court document to prove that final link. The next stage of this project will be updating all of the documents, compiling them together, updating them with headers that describe the facts that each document is intended to prove, which generation that document is being applied to, and the source information with a high degree of specificity. And that's next month's work, so when I come back around here at the end of May, I will let you know what progress I've made on that and whether the application is ready for submission. So I'm going to wrap up this month with a cautionary tale. And it's really common sense, but it bears repeating every now and then. If you're thinking maybe you should visit somebody who's kind of getting up there in years, and you're wondering, you know, whether you should or not, the answer is yes, you should. You should not wait. And I kind of moved out of my apartment right before the COVID years. And COVID kind of disrupted a lot of things. There were people I'd wanted to get back in contact with, and that was just put off month after month, year after year. Back in 2020, 2021, and a lot of 2022, but there's really not much of an excuse for that anymore. I think we've pretty much opened up. As far as I can tell, life has pretty much returned to normal for those who survived that episode. But I've always been kind of an introverted person, always putting off talking to people I should talk to, visiting people I should visit. And one of those people I've had in the back of my mind for quite some time is my dad's Aunt Lorraine. Her husband, William Harrison, was my grandmother's brother. And my grandmother died in 2008. This is the same grandmother whose death certificate I ordered last month for inclusion in my PALS application. But her brother, William, outlived her. And our family kind of lost contact with their family for a little while. But when my grandmother was in the hospital, I remember I was there visiting her, and this guy walked into the room who I kind of recognized. And, you know, we talked a bit. I was like, hey, wait, you are Uncle Bill, my dad's Uncle Bill. And that was the first I've seen him in many years. And then, interestingly, shortly after my grandmother's passing, or at least around that time. I was in law school at Rutgers Camden, and the Camden City Hall is not far from the Camden campus, and we had a field trip to the City Hall, and guess who's there as a security guard at City Hall? Completely unplanned, completely unknown. I did not know that he worked there, but it's, hey, Uncle Bill, he's there again. I keep running into this guy. So not long after that, we arranged to spend the afternoon. I went to his house in Northeast Philadelphia off of Knights Road, and I spent an afternoon with him, his wife Lorraine, and their son Mike. And I shared some of the research I've been doing. I shared some pictures. I had some pictures that I was hoping he would be able to identify. And these I found in my grandmother's old things after she passed. And I was crossing my fingers hoping that my Uncle Bill would be able to identify these pictures. But he unfortunately was not. And so those pictures, the identity of people in those pictures remains a mystery. But not long after I met and reconnected with Uncle Bill, he fell ill with a Parkinson's-like ailment. I'm not sure what the technical diagnosis was, but he passed away himself in 2012, and it doesn't feel like it was that long. If I were to guess and say, you know, when did Uncle Bill pass away, I would have said 2014, but I'm looking at my genealogy software here, and it says he died in 2012, so it's like it's amazing how time passes. It doesn't feel like quite that long. But I remember Aunt Lorraine, during our visit, was very kind, very nice, gave a lot of information, additional information. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, she's right there off of Knights Road. You know, I should call, I should text Mike and see what they're up to, maybe go and visit. But I discovered last week the obituary, online obituary of Lorraine Harrison, who was born in 1943 and passed away on the 18th of March, just over a month ago. So thoughts and prayers go out to the Harrison family on the passing of Aunt Lorraine. But then seeing this obituary online made me think of a few other people who were getting up there in years, and I should have spoken to them. And I just really didn't, and I should have. And while I was visiting Uncle Bill and Aunt Lorraine, and we were talking about family stuff, I said, what can you tell me about my Smith ancestors? And it was Aunt Lorraine who said, why don't you give Jean Quinlan a call? Now, my grandmother was Joan B. Harrison Graham. My grandmother's mother's maiden name was Joanna Christina Smith. Joanna Smith had a sister, Elizabeth, who married a John A. Quinlan. And one of their sons was James Quinlan, also known as Corky Quinlan. And this was a cousin of my grandmother. Now, Corky Quinlan was born in 1930 and died in 1991. So I don't have very many memories of him. But he married Jean Flynn in 1952, and she became Jean Quinlan. And Lorraine recommended to me that I give Jean Quinlan a call to learn more about the Smith family. And I did do this. It must have been 12 years ago at this point or more. Or I say 12, say like I was just saying, it doesn't feel like that long, but this was probably before Uncle Bill died, so it must have been 2011 or 2012. So I called Jean Quinlan. I said, what can you tell me about the Smith family? But she did not think she had a whole lot to offer. So she said, you know, I married into the family. I really don't know that much. I wanted to talk to her about, you know, what was it like living with Uncle Corky and what's her family like? But she, you know, she didn't really seem to, you know, she didn't think that she had a lot of information that I would be interested in. After I found Aunt Lorraine's obituary, I said, well, what about Jeannie Quinlan? Is she still around? She would be getting up there in years if she were still around. So I did some typing on the Google, and I discovered Jean Quinlan's obituary. And she died a little while ago. I kind of missed the notice on this one, but she died in 2018 at the age of 86. And her online obituary, it's, you know, pretty simple, just lists, you know, family members and date and time of the services and all that. But let me go back, now that I'm thinking of it, why don't I go back and read from the obituary of Aunt Lorraine, which has, you know, a little more information, but it says, Lorraine spent her career working for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia as a custodian for the former Nativity Parish in Port Richmond. in her free time. Rainy is her nickname. Enjoyed going out to eat and trying new restaurants, especially seafood. She looked forward to shopping, trips to the casino, and watching a movie with the girls. She was also an avid Sixers and Phillies fan. These are the local sports teams here in Philadelphia. Most of all, Rainey loved being with her family. She was a proud wife, mother, and grandmother who cherished time spent with her grandchildren and supporting them in all their activities. That's a little bit more about Aunt Lorraine. And Jean Quinlan's obituary is simpler. It just lists relationships and gives date and time of services. But I remember talking to Jean Quinlan, and she said, "I don't know much about the Smiths. You know who you really want to talk to? My sister-in-law, Charlotte Ibbotson." She gave me a phone number for Charlotte Ibbotson. Now, I took this phone number, and I did use it. I called the number. Person who answered the phone said, "Hey, look, thank you for calling. The family is going through a situation right now, and we won't really be available for a few weeks." And I didn't pry into, I just never spoke to these people in my life. I didn't want to pry into their business. So I just kind of left it at that. And I thought, I'll get back to them in a few weeks. But I never got back to them. And then, every now and then I'd do some Smith research, turn around and do a little Quinlan research. But I never picked up the phone to call Charlotte Ibbotson. So I was like, okay, Aunt Lorraine's gone. Jean Quinlan's gone. Is Charlotte Ibbotson still around? So I, hit the Google again, and I discovered obituary for Charlotte Jacqueline Ibbotson, born July 30th, 1937, died February 22nd, 2025, so a little over a year ago, at the age of 87. Charlotte Jacqueline Ibbotson, affectionately known as Tootsie, passed away on February 22nd, 2025. She was a daughter of the late John and Elizabeth Quinlan, née Smith. Charlotte devoted, I'm reading from her online obituary, 25 years of her life to the role of sales team administrator at the OCE Business Systems, where her diligence, professionalism, and steadfast dedication left an indelible mark on all who had the pleasure of working alongside her. And then continuing on, Charlotte was an avid sports fan who found immeasurable joy in rooting for her beloved Philadelphia teams. So we love our sports here in Philadelphia, in the greater Philadelphia area. So you'll see this in several people's obituaries, whether it's cheering passionately for the Philadelphia Eagles as they took the football field, rallying behind the Philadelphia Phillies on the diamond, or supporting the Philadelphia 76ers in their quest for basketball glory. Charlotte's fervor for sports was infectious, inspiring many around her to share in her excitement. So this seems like she would have been an upbeat person to speak to, and there's a picture of her on her online obituary where she's just kind of, her eyes are sparkling here, and it's just, I missed this opportunity. She passed away only a little over a year ago, and I had a good over 10 years I could have picked up the phone and made that connection, but a little bit of, shyness combined with a lot of procrastination, I just didn't make that happen. So now I'm left with this obituary only, and yet it references some other people who I might reach out to in the future. But knowing the daughter of the late John and Elizabeth Quinlan, née Smith, would have been good to record some of this family's history, but it's another missed opportunity. And lastly, one more. I was thinking while I'm looking up people who are getting on in years, there's one other person I've been trying to find, and this is on the entire other side of my family, my mother's side. There's a gentleman I've kind of had my eye on for genealogy purposes. His name was Marvin Arighi, and I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's spelled A-R-R-I-G-H-Y, Arighi, I think. And he's interesting to me, because he has ties to the Jewish side of my mother's family. My mother's father was Morris Anflick. His parents were Henry and Minnie. Henry's mother was Katie, and she came over from what is now the Ukraine back in the early 1900s. I believe it was 1903 or so. She came to America. And documentation is a little sparse on this family, sometimes conflicting. Dates are unclear. But I've suspected that Katie had a sister named Anna who married an Aaron Schachter. And this marriage took place in 1887. And Anna and Aaron Schachter had three children, Sarah, Marie, and Goldie. Marie Schachter married a gentleman named Columbus Arahi, and Marvin was a son of Marie and Columbus Arahi. And he was born, Marvin that is, he was born in 1923. And he just passed away this past January at the age of 102. And he would have been able to tell me more about his mother, Marie Schachter, and possibly more about his grandmother. I mean, this is a person who knew Anna, the apparent sister of my great-great-grandmother, Katie Anflick, whose maiden name is probably Karinchak. But here's a guy who may have been able to answer some of these questions for me. And it's like I would have expected. I'm like, this guy is getting up there. He's got to be in his 90s. I'm expecting to see a newspaper obituary somewhere, but I don't. He's probably still alive. I was thinking this for years. I did eventually find him on the Yellow Pages website, or is it the White Pages now? And I got a phone number, and this must have been 2 years ago, or maybe three. Like, I got a number from the Yellow Pages, and I called the number, and a woman answered the phone, and I said, was this the residence of Marvin Arahi? She said she did not know that person. So, well, the Yellow Pages number may have been outdated. This may have been a later resident of that home. But I did actually try. Like, I tried to reach out to this guy, and I was not able to make the connection. But, like, another year passed. I was like, is this guy still around, Marvin? And I didn't see any news about him, but I just, you know, I looked up this time and did find his obituary that he did pass away at the age of 102. Just this past January, maybe I can read from some of his obituary. Lifelong Philadelphia resident, Marvin grew up in the Summerdale section. Gifted athlete, he played youth football and baseball, attended Frankfort High School, was a star football player. Proud veteran, Marv joined the U.S. Army in 1943, where he served in the Army Air Corps as a gunner on B-24 bombers during World War II while stationed in England. Marvin married his beloved grade school sweetheart Betty in 1945 while on leave, only 14 days after returning home on the Queen Elizabeth II. After his honorable service to his country, he was determined to be a successful restaurateur. His dream began in 1947 with a small luncheonette, Betty Lou's on Castor Avenue. In 1959, he built the Robin Hood restaurant in Busselton and opened his second Robin Hood in 1964 in Southampton. He also owned and operated the Sherwood House in Morrisville. So it's a relatively prominent person in the community, and it's like I'm surprised I didn't turn up more when I searched for him online. It also says he was a longtime member of Tarsdale Frankfort Country Club, where he was known as Marvelous Marvin and won the club championship. He was also a lifetime member of the Golf Association of Philadelphia. So Marvin Arahi, I've been hoping to speak to this guy for quite some time, but again, missed the opportunity. Maybe a little more determination, I could maybe have found him and asked him about his grandmother. But that opportunity seems to have passed along with Marvin back on the 19th of January of this year. So this is your reminder. Please go find these folks who are getting up in years and do your best to meet them and speak with them. Remember, the human mind is the most fragile genealogical resource, and once these people are gone, there's a lot that goes with them. So I just thought I'd share that with you today. These are folks that I missed and didn't quite get a chance to speak to as much as I should have. All right, folks, that's it for this month. Next month, I hope to have more of my pals application in order and potentially ready for submission. I'll tell you all about that when the time comes. But for now, I've been Tim. The website is genealogybytim.com. The email address is tim@genealogybytim.com. Until next month, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits. Was just put off month after month, year after year. Back in 2020, 2021, and a lot of 2022